They were still arguing with the guards at the gate, who had their inflexible orders, as Ezio made his way through the revellers to make contact with Teodora. She greeted him warmly. "You made it. Congratulations. Now listen. Marco remains very cautious indeed. He's staying on his boat, the Ducal Bucintoro, on the water just off the Molo. You won't be able to get all that close to him, but you should find the best vantage point for your attack." She turned to summon three or four of her courtesans. "These girls will help cover your movements as you make your way through the party." Ezio set off. But as the girls, radiant in shimmering silver and red satins and silks, moved through the sea of guests, his attention was taken by a tall, dignified man in his mid-60s, with clear, intelligent eyes and a white spade beard, who was talking to a Venetian noble of similar age. Both wore small masks which covered little of the face, and Ezio recognized the first of them as Agostino Barbarigo, the younger brother of Marco. Agostino might have a lot to do with the fate of Venice if anything untoward should happen to his brother, and Ezio thought it expedient to maneuver himself into a position from which he could overhear the man's conversation. As Ezio edged up, Agostino was laughing gently. "Honestly, my brother embarrasses himself with this display."
"You have no right to speak of him that way," replied the noble. "He is the Doge."
"Yes, yes, he is the Doge," replied Agostino, stroking his beard.
"This is his party, his carnevale, and he'll spend his money as he sees fit."
"He's the Doge in name only," Agostino said, rather more sharply. "And it's Venetian money that he's spending, not his own." He lowered his voice. "There are larger things at stake, and you know it. Marco was the man chosen to lead. It's true your father may have thought that he'd never amount to much, and so transferred his political ambitions to you, but that hardly matters now, does it, given how things stand?"
"I never wanted to be Doge."
"Then I congratulate you on your success," said the nobleman, coldly.
"Look," said Agostino, keeping his temper, "power is more than wealth. Does my brother truly believe he was chosen for any other reason than his riches?"
"He was chosen for his wisdom and his leadership."
They were interrupted by the beginning of the firework display. Agostino watched it for a moment, then said,
"And this is what he does with such wisdom? Offer a light show? He hides away in the ducal palace while the city comes apart at the seams, and then thinks some expensive explosions will make people forget all their problems."
The noble made a dismissive gesture.
"The people love the spectacle. It's human nature, you'll see."
But at that moment Ezio spotted the burly figure of Dante in the company of a posse of guards barging through the party, doubtless looking for him. He continued to make his way to an unexposed spot from where he might gain access to the Doge if he ever left the Bucintoro, moored a few yards out from the quay. There was a fanfare, and for now the fireworks ceased. The people fell silent, then broke into applause as Marco came to the port side of his state barge to address them, and a page introduced him.
"Signore e signori, I present to you the beloved Doge of Venezia."
Marco began his address.
"Benvenuti. Welcome, my friends, to the grandest social event of the season. In peace or at war, in times of prosperity or paucity, Venezia will always have carnevale."
As the Doge continued to speak, Teodora rejoined Ezio.
"It's too far," Ezio told her. "And he's not going to leave the boat. So I'll have to swim out there. Merda."
"I wouldn't try it," said Teodora in hushed tones. "You'd be spotted right away."
"Then I'll have to fight my way out the—"
"Wait." The Doge was continuing.
"Tonight, we celebrate what makes us great. How brightly our lights shine over the world."
He spread his arms, and there was another short firework display. The crowd cheered and roared their approval.
"That's it," said Teodora. "Use your pistola. The one you stopped the murderer with in my bordello. Use the sound of the fireworks when they start again to cover the noise of your gunshot.
Time it right, and you'll walk out of here unnoticed." Ezio looked at her.
"I like the way you think, sister."
"You'll just have to be very careful how you aim. You'll only get one chance." She squeezed his arm.
"Buona fortuna, my son. I'll be waiting for you back at the bordello."
She vanished among the partygoers, among whom Ezio could also see Dante and his goons still searching for him. Silent as a wraith, he made his way to a point on the quay as close as he dared get to the spot where Marco was standing on the barge. Fortunately, his resplendent robes, bathed in the lights of the party, made him an excellent target. The Doge's speech continued, and Ezio used it to prepare himself, listening carefully for the resumption of the fireworks. His timing would have to be accurate if he was to get his shot off undetected.
"We all know we have come through troubled times," Marco was saying. "But we have come through them together, and Venezia stands a stronger city for it. Transitions of power are difficult for all, but we have weathered the shift with grace and tranquility. It is no easy thing to lose a doge in the prime of life, and it is frustrating to see our dear brother Mocenigo's assassin still roam free and unpunished. However, we may comfort ourselves with the thought that many of us were beginning to grow uncomfortable with my predecessor's policies, to feel unsafe, and to doubt the road he was guiding us down."
Several voices in the crowd were raised in agreement, and Marco, smiling, held up his hands for silence.
"Well, my friends, I can tell you that I have found the right road for us again. I can see down it, and I know where we are going. It's a beautiful place, and we're going there together. The future I see for Venezia is a future of strength, a future of wealth. We will build a fleet so strong that our enemies will fear us as never before, and we will expand our trade routes across the seas and bring home spices and treasures undreamed of since Marco Polo's time."
Marco's eyes glittered as his voice took on a minatory tone.
"And I say this to those who stand against us. Be careful which side of the line you choose, because either you are with us, or you are on the side of evil. And we will harbour no enemies here. We will hunt you down, we will root you out, we will destroy you."
He raised his hands again and declaimed,
"And Venezia shall always stand, the brightest jewel in all civilization."
As he let his arms fall in triumph, a mighty display of fireworks went up, a grand finale which turned night into day. The noise of the explosions was deafening. Ezio's little lethal gunshot was quite lost in it. And he was well on his way out through the crowd before the people in it had had time to react to the sight of Marco Barbarigo, one of the shortest reigning doges in Venetian history, stagger, clutching at his heart, and falling dead on the deck of the ducal barge. "Requiescat in pace," Ezio muttered to himself as he went. But once the news was out, it travelled fast, and reached the brothel before Ezio did. He was greeted with cries of admiration from Teodora and her courtesans.
"You must be exhausted," said Teodora, taking his arm and leading him away from the others towards an inner room.
"Come, relax." But first Antonio offered his congratulations.
"The saviour of Venice!" he exclaimed. "What can I say? Perhaps it was wrong of me to doubt so readily. Now at least we'll have a chance to see where the pieces fall."
"Enough of that now," said Teodora.
"Come, Ezio.
You've worked hard, my son. I feel your tired body is in need of comfort and succour."
Ezio was quick to catch her meaning, and played along. "It is true, sister. I have such aches and pains that I may need a great deal of comfort and succour. I hope you're up to it."
"Oh," grinned Teodora, "I don't intend to ease your pain single-handed. Girls?"
A gaggle of courtesans slipped smilingly past Ezio into the inner room, at the centre of which he could see a truly massive bed, by whose side was a singular contraption like a couch, but with pulleys and belts and chains. It reminded him of something out of Leonardo's workshop, but he couldn't imagine what possible use it might be put to. He exchanged a long look with Teodora and followed her into the bedroom, closing the door firmly behind him. A couple of days later, Ezio was standing on the Rialto Bridge, relaxed and refreshed, and watching the crowds go by. He was just considering leaving to go and drink a couple of glasses of Veneto before the ora di pranzo, when he saw a man he recognized hurrying towards him, one of Antonio's messengers.
"Ezio! Ezio!" the man said as he came up. "Ser Antonio wishes to see you. It's a matter of importance."
"Then we'll go immediately," said Ezio, following him off the bridge. They found Antonio in his office in the company, to Ezio's surprise, of Agostino Barbarigo. Antonio made the introductions.
"It is an honour to meet you, sir."
"I'm sorry for the loss of your brother." Agostino waved a hand.
"I appreciate your sympathy, but to be frank, my brother was a fool and completely under the control of the Borgia faction in Rome, something I would not wish on Venice ever. Luckily, some public-spirited person has averted that danger by assassinating him, in a curiously original way. There will be inquiries, of course, but I am at a loss, personally, to see where they will lead."
"Messer Agostino is shortly to be elected Doge," put in Antonio. "It is good news for Venice."
"The Council of 41 has worked fast this time," said Ezio, dryly.
"I think they have learnt the error of their ways," replied Agostino, with a wry smile. "But I do not wish to be Doge in name only, as my brother was. Which brings us to the business in hand. Our ghastly cousin, Silvio, has occupied the arsenal, the military quarter of town, and garrisoned it with 200 mercenaries."
"But when you are Doge, can't you command them to stand down?" asked Ezio.
"It would be nice to think so," said Agostino. "But my brother's extravagances have depleted the city's resources, and we will be hard put to it to withstand the determined force who have control of the arsenal. And without the arsenal, I have no real control of Venice, Doge or no Doge."
"Then," said Ezio, "we must raise a determined force of our own."
"Well said," Antonio beamed. "And I think I have just the man for the job. Have you heard of Bartolomeo d'Alviano?"
"Of course, the condottiero who used to serve the Papal States. He's turned against them, I know.
And just now he's based here. He has little love for Silvio, who, as you know, is also in Cardinal Borgia's pocket," said Agostino. "Bartolomeo's based on San Pietro, east of the arsenal."
"I'll go and see him."
"Before you do that, Ezio," said Antonio, "Messer Agostino has something for you."
From his robes, Agostino withdrew a rolled, ancient vellum scroll with a heavy black seal, broken, hanging from a tattered red ribbon.
"My brother had it among his papers.
Antonio thought it might interest you. Consider it a payment for services rendered." Ezio took it. He knew immediately what it was.
"Thank you, signore.
I'm sure this will be of great help in the battle which will surely come." Pausing only to arm himself, Ezio wasted no time in making his way to Leonardo's workshop, where he was surprised to find his friend in the process of packing up.
"Where are you off to now?" asked Ezio.
"Back to Milan. I was going to send you a message before I left, of course, and to send you a packet of bullets for your little gun."
"Well, I'm very glad I've caught you. Look, I have another codex page."
"Excellent. I'm most interested in seeing those. Come in. My servant Luca and the others can carry on with this. I've got them quite well trained by now. Pity I can't take them all with me."
"What are you going to do in Milan?"
"Lodovico Sforza made me an offer I couldn't refuse."
"But what about your projects here?"
"The Navy's had to cancel. No money for new projects. Apparently the last Doge ran through most of it. I could have done him fireworks, no need to have gone to all the expense of sending off to China for them.
Never mind. Venice is still at peace with the Turks, and they've told me I'm welcome to come back. In fact, I think they'd like me to. Meanwhile, I'm leaving Luca behind. He'd be a fish out of water away from Venice, with a few basic designs to get them started. And as for the Conte, he's happy with his family portraits, though, personally, I think they could do with more work. Leonardo started to unroll the vellum sheet. Now, let's have a look at this. Promise you'll let me know when you return here. I promise, my friend. And you, keep me posted on your movements if you can. I will. Now. Leonardo spread the codex page out and examined it. There's something here that looks like a blueprint for the double-bladed knife that went with your metal guard bracer. But it's incomplete, and maybe an earlier draft of the design. The rest can only be significant in connection with the other pages. Look, there are more map-like markings and some kind of picture that puts me in mind of those complex knot patterns I used to doodle when I had any time to think for myself. Leonardo rolled up the page again and looked at Ezio. I'd put this in a safe place with the other two pages you've shown me here in Venice. They're all clearly of great significance. Actually, Leo, if you're going to Milan, I wonder if I might ask you a favour. Fire away. When you get to Padua, would you please organise a trustworthy courier to take these three pages to my Uncle Mario in Monteriggioni? He's an antiquarian, and I know he'll find them interesting. But I need someone I can depend on to do this for me. Leonardo gave him the ghost of a smile. If Ezio hadn't been so preoccupied, he might almost have thought it knowing. I'm sending my staff straight on to Milan, but as for myself, I'm paying a flying visit, to coin a phrase, to Florence first, to check on Agnolo and Innocento. So I'll be your courier as far as there, and I'll send Agnolo on to Monteriggioni with them, have no fear. That is better than I could have hoped for. Ezio grasped his hand. You are a good and wonderful friend, Leo. I certainly hope so, Ezio. Occasionally, I think you could do with someone truly to look out for you. He paused. And I wish you well in your work. I hope, one day, you will be able to bring it to a conclusion and find rest. A distant look came into Ezio's steel-grey eyes. But he didn't reply, except to say, "You've reminded me. I have another errand to run. I'll send one of my host's men over with the other two codex pages. And now, for the moment, addio."
Chapter 20. The quickest way to reach San Pietro from Leonardo's workshop was by taking the ferry or hiring a boat from the Fondamenta Nuova and sailing east from the north shores of the city. To his surprise, Ezio found it hard to get anyone to take him there. The regular ferries had been suspended, and it was only by digging deep into his pockets that he managed to persuade a pair of young gondoliers to make the journey. "What's the problem?" he asked them. "Word is there's been some bad fighting down there," said the aft oarsman, straining against choppy water. "Seems that it's died down now, just a local feud. But the ferries aren't risking starting up again just yet. We'll drop you on the north foreshore. Just keep an eye out for yourself." They did as they had promised. Ezio soon found himself alone, plodding up a muddy bank to the brick retaining wall, from where he could see the spire of the church of San Pietro di Castello a short way off. What he could also see was several plumes of smoke rising from a group of low brick buildings some distance southeast of the church. They were Bartolomeo's barracks. His heart pounding, Ezio hastened in their direction. The first thing that struck him was the silence. Then, as he drew nearer, he began to see dead bodies strewn around, some of the men wearing the blazon of Silvio Barbarigo, others a device he did not recognize. Finally, he came upon a sergeant, badly wounded but still alive, who had managed to prop himself up against a low wall.
"Please, help me," said the sergeant when Ezio approached.
Ezio searched around quickly and located the well, from which he drew water, praying that the attackers had not poisoned it, though it looked clean and clear enough. He poured some into a beaker he'd found and put it gently to the man's lips. then moistened a cloth and wiped the blood from his face.
"Thank you, friend," said the sergeant.
Ezio noticed that he wore the unfamiliar badge and guessed that it must be Bartolomeo's. Evidently Bartolomeo's troops had been worsted by Silvio's.
"It was a surprise attack," the sergeant confirmed. "Some whore of Bartolomeo's betrayed us."
"Where have they gone now?"
"The Inquisitor's men. Back to the arsenal. They've established a base there just before the new doge could take control. Silvio hates his cousin Agostino because he isn't part of whatever plot the Inquisitor's involved in."
The man coughed blood, but endeavoured to continue.
"Took our captain prisoner. Carried him off with them. Funny, really. We were just planning to attack them. Bartolomeo was simply waiting for a messenger from the city."
"Where are the rest of your men now?" The sergeant tried to look around. "Those that weren't killed or taken prisoner scattered. Tried to save themselves. They'll be lying low in Venice and on the islands in the lagoon. But they'll need someone to unite behind. They'll be waiting for word of the captain."
"And he's a prisoner of Silvio?" "Yes, he..."
But the unfortunate sergeant here started to fight for breath. His struggle ended as his mouth opened and a shower of blood streamed from it, drenching the grass for 3 yards in front of him. By the time the flow had stopped, the man's eyes were staring sightlessly in the direction of the lagoon. Ezio closed them for him and crossed his arms on his chest. "Requiescat in pace," he said solemnly. Then he hitched his sword belt tighter. He had also strapped the guard brace to his left forearm, but had left off the double-bladed dagger attachment. To his right forearm, he had attached the poison blade, always so useful when faced with huge odds. The pistol, most useful when a single, certain target was in view, as it had to be reloaded after each firing, he kept in his belt pouch with powder and shot, and the original spring blade as backup. He pulled up his hood and headed for the wooden bridge which connected San Pietro to Castello. From there he made his way unobtrusively but quickly down the main street in the direction of the arsenal. He noticed that the people around him were subdued, though they went about their daily work as usual. It would take more than a local war to stop the business of Venice entirely, though of course few of the ordinary citizens of Castello could know just how important for their city the outcome of this conflict was. Ezio didn't know then that it would be a conflict which would drag on for many, many months, indeed, into the following year. He thought of Christina, of his mother Maria and his sister Claudia. And he felt himself to be homeless, and getting older. But there was the creed to be served and upheld, and that was more important than anything else. No one, perhaps, would ever know that their world had been saved from the dominion of the Templars, by the select order of assassins, which had pledged itself to opposing their evil hegemony. His first task was clearly to locate and, if possible, free Bartolomeo d'Alviano, but getting into the arsenal would be hard. Surrounded by high brick fortified walls and containing a warren of buildings and shipyards, it stood at the eastern limit of the main city, and it was heavily guarded by Silvio's private army, whose numbers seemed to exceed the 200 mercenaries Agostino Barbarigo had told him of. Ezio, passing the architect Gamballo's recently built main gate, wandered round the outside perimeters of the building as far as they were accessible by land, until he came to a heavy door with a wicket gate built into it, and, observing from a distance, saw that this unobtrusive entry was used by guards on the outside when they changed shift. He had to wait, unobtrusively, for 4 hours. But at the next shift change, he was ready. It was baking hot in the late afternoon sun. The atmosphere was humid, and everyone except Ezio was torpid. He watched as the relief soldiers marched out through the gate, which had only one guard, and then followed the mercenaries coming off shift, bringing up the rear and blending in as best he could. Once the last soldier was through, he cut the throat of the guard posted at the gate and slipped through it himself before anyone had noticed what was happening. As had happened years ago at San Gimignano, Silvio's force here, big as it was, wasn't sufficient to cover the entire area it guarded. It was, after all, the city's military focal point. No wonder Agostino couldn't wield any real power without control of it. Once inside, it was relatively easy to move about between the wide-open spaces between the huge buildings, the Cordelia, the Artigliere, the shot towers, and above all, the shipyards. As long as Ezio kept to the dark, late-afternoon shadows, and took care to avoid the patrols within the vast complex, he knew he would be all right, though naturally he remained extremely vigilant. Guided at last by the sounds of merriment and mocking laughter, he found his way to the side of one of the main dry docks, into which a massive galley was drawn. On the side of one of the dock's massive walls, an iron cage had been hung. In it was Bartolomeo, a vigorous bear of a man in his early 30s, and so just 4 or 5 years Ezio's senior. Around him was a crowd of Silvio's mercenaries, and Ezio thought how much better employed they'd have been patrolling than triumphing over an enemy they'd already rendered helpless. But he reflected that Silvio Barbarigo, Grand Inquisitor though he was not experienced in matters of handling troops. Ezio didn't know how long Bartolomeo had been chained up in his cage, certainly for many hours, but his anger and energy seemed unaffected by his ordeal. Given that he'd almost certainly been given nothing to eat or drink, this was remarkable.
"Luridi codardi! Filthy cowards!"
he was shouting at his tormentors, one of whom, Ezio noticed, had dipped a sponge in vinegar and was pushing it up to Bartolomeo's lips on the tip of a lance, in the hope that he'd think it was water. Bartolomeo spat it away.
"I'll take you all on, at the same time, with one arm, no, both arms tied behind my back. I'll fucking eat you alive,"
he laughed.
"You must be wondering how such a thing could be even possible, but just let me out of here and I'll gladly demonstrate. Miserabili pezzi di merda."
The Inquisitor's guards howled in derision, and poked at Bartolomeo with poles, making the cage swing. It had no solid bottom, and Bartolomeo had to grip hard with his feet on the bars beneath to keep his balance.
"You have no honour, no valour, no virtue!"
He summoned enough saliva into his mouth to spit down at them.
"And people wonder why the Star of Venice has begun to wane!"
Then his voice took on almost a pleading tone.
"I'll show mercy to whomever here has the courage to release me. All the rest of you are going to die, by my hand. I swear it!"
"Save your fucking breath," one of the guards called out. "No one's going to die today but you, you fucking turdbag."
All this time, Ezio, sheltered by the shadow of a brick colonnade that skirted a basin where some of the smaller war galleys were moored, was working out a way of saving the condottiero. There were 10 guards around the cage, all with their backs to him, and there was none other in view. What was more, they were off duty and had no armour on. Ezio checked his poison dagger. Dispatching the guards should present no difficulty. He timed the passing of the on-duty patrols, and they came by every time the shadow of the dock wall lengthened by 3 inches. But there was the additional problem of releasing Bartolomeo, keeping him quiet while doing so, and making quick work of it. He thought hard. He knew there wasn't much time.
"What sort of man sells his honour and dignity for a few pieces of silver?"
Bartolomeo was bellowing, but his throat was getting dry and he was running out of steam, despite his iron will.
"Isn't that what you do, fuckwit? Aren't you a mercenary like us?"
"I have never been in the service of a traitor and a coward as you are."
Bartolomeo's eyes glittered. The men standing beneath him were momentarily cowed.
"Do you think I don't know why you've chained me up? Do you think I don't know who your boss Silvio's puppet master is? I've been fighting the weasel who controls him since most of you boys were puppies, suckling your mother's teats."
Ezio was now listening with interest. One of the soldiers picked up a half brick and threw it angrily. It bounced harmlessly off the bars of the cage.
"That's right, you fuckers,"
Bartolomeo yelled hoarsely.
"You just try it on with me. I swear, once I'm free of this cage, I'm going to make it my mission to sever each and every one of your fucking heads and shove them up your fucking girly asses. And I'll mix and match the heads too, because you little tykes clearly don't know your heads from your asses anyway."
The men below were getting seriously angry now. It was clear that only orders prevented them from stabbing the man to death with their pikes, or shooting arrows at him, as he hung defencelessly above them in his cage. But by now Ezio had seen that the padlock which secured the door of the cage was relatively small. Bartolomeo's captors relied on the fact that the cage was hung high. No doubt they intended that the harsh sun of the day and chill of the night, coupled with dehydration and starvation, would finish him off unless he broke down and agreed to talk. But from the look of him, that was something Bartolomeo would never do. Ezio knew he had to act fast. An on-duty patrol would pass by very shortly. Releasing the spring on his poison blade, he moved forward with the speed and grace of a wolf, covering the distance in a matter of seconds. He scythed through the group, and had sliced death into the bodies of five men before the others knew what was happening. Drawing his sword, he savagely killed the rest, their vain blows glancing off the metal guard on his left forearm, while Bartolomeo watched open-mouthed. At last, silent, Ezio turned and looked up. "Can you jump from there?" he asked.
"If you can get me out, I'll jump like a fucking flea!"
Ezio grabbed one of the dead soldier's pikes. Its point was iron, not steel, and cast, not forged. It would do. Balancing it in his left hand, he prepared himself, crouched, and sprang into the air, at last clinging to the outer bars of the cage. Bartolomeo looked at him, pop-eyed.
"How in buggery did you do that?" he asked.
"Training," said Ezio, smiling tightly. He forced the point of the pike through the hasp of the lock and twisted. It resisted at first, then broke. Ezio pulled the door open, free-falling to the ground as he did so, and landing with the grace of a cat. "Now you jump," he ordered. "Be quick."
"Who are you? Get on with it."
Nervously, Bartolomeo braced himself against the open door of the cage, and then flung himself forwards. He landed heavily, the breath knocked out of him. But when Ezio helped him to his feet, he shook his rescuer off proudly.
"I'm all right," he huffed. "I'm just not used to doing fucking circus tricks."
"No bones broken, then?"
"Fuck you, whoever you are," said Bartolomeo, beaming. "But you have my thanks."
And to Ezio's surprise, he gave him a bear hug.
"Who are you, anyway? The arch-fucking angel Gabriel, or what?"
"My name is Auditore, Ezio."
"Bartolomeo Dalviani. Delighted."
"We haven't got time for this," Ezio snapped, "as you well know."
"Don't try to teach me my job, acrobat,"
said Bartolomeo, still quite genially.
"Anyway, I owe you one for this."
But they had already wasted too much time. Someone must have noticed from the ramparts what was going on, for now alarm bells started to ring, and patrols emerged from the buildings nearby to close on them.
"Come on, you bastards!"
bellowed Bartolomeo, swinging fists that made Dante Moro's look like panelling hammers. It was Ezio's turn to look on admiringly, as Bartolomeo ploughed into the oncoming soldiers. Together they beat their way back to the wicket gate, and at last were clear.
"Let's get out of here," Ezio exclaimed.
"Shouldn't we break a few more heads?"
"Perhaps we should try to avoid conflict for now."
"Are you afraid?"
"Just practical. I know your blood's up, but they do outnumber us by 100 to 1. Bartolomeo considered.
"You have a point. And after all, I'm a commander. I ought to think like one, not leave it to some whippersnapper like you to make me see sense."
And then he lowered his voice and said in a concerned tone,
"I just hope my little Bianca is safe."
Ezio didn't have time to question or even wonder about Bartolomeo's aside. They had to make tracks, and they did, racing through the town back towards Bartolomeo's headquarters on San Pietro. But not before Bartolomeo had made two important diversions, to the Riva San Basio and the Corte Nuova, to alert his agents in those places that he was alive and free, and to summon his scattered forces, those who had not been taken prisoner, to regroup. Back at San Pietro at dusk, they found that a handful of Bartolomeo's condottieri had survived the attack and had now emerged from their hiding places, moving among the already fly-blown dead and attempting to bury them and put matters in order. They were elated to see their captain again, but he was distracted, running here and there in his encampment, calling mournfully,
"Bianca! Bianca! Where are you?"
"Who's he after?" Ezio asked a sergeant-at-arms. "She must be worth a lot to him." "She is, signore," grinned the sergeant, "and far more reliable than most of her sex." Ezio ran to catch up with his new ally. "Is everything all right?"
"What do you think? Look at the state of this place! And poor Bianca! If something's happened to her..."
The big man shouldered a door, already half off its hinges, onto the ground, and entered a bunker which, from the look of it, must have been a map room before the attack. The valuable maps had been mutilated or stolen, but Bartolomeo sifted through the wreckage until, with a cry of triumph,
"Bianca! Oh, my darling, thank God you're all right!"
He had pulled a massive greatsword clear of the rubble, and brandished it, roaring.
"Aha! You're safe! I never doubted it! Bianca, meet... what's your name again?"
"Auditore, Ezio." Bartolomeo looked thoughtful.
"Of course. Your reputation goes before you, Ezio."
"I'm glad of it."
"What brings you here?"
"I, too, have business with Silvio Barbarigo. I think he's outstayed his welcome in Venice."
"Silvio, that turd! He needs flushing down a fucking latrine!"
"I thought I might be able to rely on your help."
"After that rescue, I owe you my life, let alone my help."
"How many men do you have?"
"How many survivors here, sergeant-at-arms?"
The sergeant-at-arms Ezio had spoken to earlier came running up and saluted. 12, Capitano, including you and me, and this gentleman here."
13,
shouted Bartolomeo, waving Bianca. "Against a good 200, said Ezio. He turned to the sergeant-at-arms. "And how many of your men did they take prisoner?" "Most of them," the man replied. "The attack took us completely by surprise. Some fled, but Silvio's men took far more away with them in chains."
"Look, Ezio," said Bartolomeo, "I'm going to supervise rounding up the rest of my men who are at liberty. I'll get this place cleaned up and bury my dead, and we'll regroup here. Do you think in the meantime you can see to the business of liberating the men Silvio's taken prisoner, since that's a thing you seem to be very good at?"
"Intensi."
"Get back here with them as soon as you can. Good luck!"
Ezio, his codex weapons buckled on, headed westward again towards the arsenal, but wondered if Silvio would have kept all Bartolomeo's men prisoner there. He hadn't seen any of them when he had gone to rescue their captain. At the arsenal itself, he stuck to the shadows of the falling night and tried to listen to the conversations of the guards stationed along the perimeter walls. "Have you ever seen bigger cages?" said one.
"No, and the poor bastards are crammed into them like sardines." "I don't think Captain Barto would have treated us like that if he'd been the victor," said his comrade.
"Of course he would. And keep your noble thoughts to yourself if you want to keep your head on your shoulders. I say finish them off. Why don't we just lower the cages into the basins and drown the lot of them?" At that, Ezio tensed. There were 3 huge rectangular basins inside the arsenal, each designed to hold 30 galleys. They were on the north side of the complex, surrounded by thick brick walls and covered by heavy wooden roofs. Doubtless the cages, larger versions of the one which had imprisoned Bartolomeo, were suspended by chains over the water in one or more of the bacini.
150 trained men. That'd be a waste. For my money, Silvio's hoping to turn them to our cause," said the second uniform.
"Well, they're mercenaries like us, so why not?"
"Right. They just need to be softened up a little first. Show them who's boss."
"Spero di sì."
"Thank God they don't know their boss has escaped," the first guard spat. "He won't last long."
Ezio left them and made his way to the wicket gate he'd discovered earlier. There was no time to wait for any changing of the guard, but he could judge the time by the distance of the moon from the horizon, and he knew he had a couple of hours. He flicked the spring blade out, his original codex weapon and still his favourite, and slashed open the throat of the fat old guard Silvio had seen fit to put on duty alone there, pushing him clear before any of the man's blood could get onto his clothes. Quickly he wiped the blade clean on the grass and exchanged it for his poison blade. He made the sign of the cross over the body. The compound within the walls of the arsenal looked different by the light of a sickle moon and a few stars, but Ezio knew where the basins were located and went, skirting the walls and keeping an ever-watchful eye out for Silvio's men, to the first one. He peered through the great open arches into the watery gloom beyond, but could see nothing but galleys bobbing gently in the half-light of the stars. The second bore the same fruit, but as he approached the third, he heard voices.
"It's not too late for you to pledge yourselves to our cause. Only say the word and you'll be spared," one of the Inquisitor's sergeants was calling in a mocking tone. Ezio, pressing himself against the wall, saw a dozen troops, weapons laid down, bottles in their hands, gazing up into the gloom of the roof, where three massive iron cages were suspended. He saw that an invisible mechanism was slowly lowering the cages towards the water beneath, and there were no galleys in this basin. Only black, oily water, in which something unseen but frightful teemed. The Inquisitor's guards included one man who wasn't drinking, a man who seemed constantly on the alert, a huge, terrible man. Ezio instantly recognized Dante Moro. So, with the death of his master Marco, the Man-Mountain had transferred his allegiance to the cousin, Silvio, the Inquisitor, who had already professed his admiration for the massive bodyguard. Ezio made his way cautiously round the walls until he came to a large open-frame box containing an arrangement of cogwheels, pulleys, and ropes that might have been designed by Leonardo. This was the mechanism, driven by a water clock, which was lowering the cages. Ezio drew his ordinary dagger from its sheath on the left-hand side of his belt and jammed it between two of the cogwheels. The mechanism stopped, and not before time, for the cages were now inches from the water's surface. But the guards instantly noticed that the cage's descent had ceased, and some came running towards the machinery that controlled it. Ezio sprang out his poison blade and hacked at them as they came. Two fell into the water from the jetty and screamed briefly, sinking into the oily black water. Meanwhile, Ezio raced along the perimeter of the basin towards the others, all of whom fled in alarm save Dante, who stood his ground and loomed like a tower over Ezio. "Silvio's dog now, are you?" said Ezio.
"Better a live dog than a dead lion," said Dante,
reaching out to cuff Ezio into the water.
"Stand down," said Ezio, ducking the blow. "I have no quarrel with you."
"Oh, shut your face," said Dante,
picking Ezio up by the scruff of the neck and bashing him against the wall of the basin.
"I have no serious quarrel with you either."
He could see that Ezio was stunned.
"Just stay there. I must go and warn my master, but I'll be back to feed you to the fishes if you give me any more trouble."
And he was gone. Ezio shook his head to clear it, and stood up, groggily. The men in the cages were shouting, and Ezio saw that one of Silvio's guards had crept back in, and was about to dislodge the dagger he'd jammed in the cage-lowering mechanism. He thanked God he had not forgotten his old knife-throwing skills learned at Monteriggioni, produced a knife from his belt, and hurled it with deadly accuracy. The guard stumbled over, groaning, snatching helplessly at the blade which was buried between his eyes. Ezio snatched a gaff from a rack on the wall behind him, and, leaning over the water dangerously, deftly hauled the nearest cage towards him. Its door was closed by a simple bolt, and he shot it back, releasing the men inside, who tumbled out onto the wharf. With their help, he was able to haul in the remaining cages and release their prisoners in turn. Exhausted though they were by their ordeal, they cheered him.
"Come on," he cried. "I've got to get you back to your captain."
Once they had overwhelmed the men guarding the basins, they returned unopposed to San Pietro, where Bartolomeo and his men had an emotional reunion. In Ezio's absence, all the mercenaries who'd escaped Silvio's initial onslaught had returned, and the encampment was once again in perfetto ordine.
"Salute, Ezio," said Bartolomeo. "Welcome back, and well done, by God! I knew I could depend on you."
He took Ezio's hands between his.
"You are indeed the mightiest of allies. One might almost think..."
But then he stopped himself, and said instead,
"Thanks to you, my army is restored to its former glory. Now our friend Silvio will see just how grave a mistake he's made."
"So what should we do? Make a direct assault on the arsenal?"
"No. A head-on assault would mean we'd be massacred at the gates. I think we should plant my men throughout the district and get them to cause enough trouble locally to tie most of Silvio's men up.
So, if the arsenal is almost empty,
you can take it with a hand-picked team.
Let's hope he takes the bait.
He's an inquisitor. He knows how to bully people who are already at his mercy. He's not a soldier. Hell, he doesn't even have the wit to be a halfway decent chess player.
It took a few days to deploy Bartolomeo's condottieri about Castello and the arsenal district. When all was ready, Bartolomeo and Ezio gathered the small group of hand-picked mercenaries they'd kept back for the assault on Silvio's bastion. Ezio himself had selected the men for their agility and skill at arms. They'd planned the assault on the arsenal with care. The following Friday night, all was in readiness. A mercenary was sent to the top of the tower of San Martino, and when the moon was at its height, he set off a massive Roman candle designed and provided by Leonardo's workshop. This was the signal for the attack. Dressed in dark leather gear, the condottieri of the task force scaled the walls of the arsenal on all four sides. Once over the battlements, the men moved like spectres through the quiet and undermanned fortress and quickly contained the skeleton guard within. It wasn't long before Ezio and Bartolomeo found themselves confronting their deadliest foes, Silvio and Dante. Dante, wearing iron knuckle dusters, was swinging a massive chain mace around, protecting his master. It was hard for either Ezio or Bartolomeo to come within range as their own men engaged the enemy. "A fine specimen, isn't he?" crowed Silvio from the safety of the ramparts. "You should be honored to die by his hand."
"Suck my balls, you fuck!" Bartolomeo yelled back.
He'd managed to snag the mace in his battle staff, and Dante, his weapon torn from his hand, retreated.
"Come on, Ezio! We need to catch that grassone bastardo!"
Dante turned, having reached his objective, an iron club pierced with twisted nails, and faced them again. He swung it at Bartolomeo, and one of the nails tore a furrow in his shoulder.
"I'll have you for that, you pig-eyed sack of shit!"
bellowed Bartolomeo. Meanwhile, Ezio had loaded and fired his pistol at Silvio, and missed. His shot ricocheted off the brick walls in a shower of sparks and splinters.
"Do you think I don't know why you're really here, Auditore?" Silvio barked, though clearly frightened by the gunshot. "But you're too late. There's nothing you can do to stop us now."
Ezio had reloaded and fired again, but he was angry and confused at Silvio's words, and once again the shot went wide.
"Ha!" spat Silvio from the ramparts as Dante and Bartolomeo slogged it out. "You pretend you don't know. Though once Dante's done with you and your muscle-bound friend, it'll hardly matter either way. You'll just follow your fool of a father. Do you know what my greatest regret is? That I couldn't have been Giovanni's hangman myself. How I would have loved to pull that lever and watch your miserable dad kick and gasp and dangle. And then, of course, there would have been plenty of time for that winesack of an uncle of yours, Ciccione Mario, and your not quite past it mother, Droopy Dugs Maria, and that luscious little strawberry Claudia, your sister. How long it's been since I fucked anything under 25. Mind you, I'd keep the last two for the voyage. It can get quite lonely out at sea."
Through the red mist of his fury, Ezio concentrated on the information the spittle-strewn lips of the Inquisitor were madly spewing forth along with the insults. By now, Silvio's guards, at superior odds, were beginning to rally against Bartolomeo's commandos. Dante dealt another swinging blow at Bartolomeo, thumping him in the ribcage with his knuckle-dusters and causing him to falter. Ezio fired a third bullet at Silvio, and this time it ripped through the Inquisitor's robes close to his neck. But though the man staggered, and Ezio saw a thin line of blood, he did not fall. He shouted a command to Dante, who fell back, swarming up to the rampart to join his master, and with him disappearing over the other side of the wall. Ezio knew there'd be a ladder on the other side to take them down to the jetty, and yelling to Bartolomeo to follow him, he dashed out of the arena of battle to cut his foes off. He saw them clambering into a large boat, but noticed the anger and despair on their faces. Following their gaze, he saw a huge black galley disappearing across the lagoon southwards.
"We've been betrayed," Ezio heard Silvio say to Dante. "The ship has sailed without us. God damn them! I've been nothing but loyal, and yet this is how they repay me."
"Let's use this boat to catch them up," said Dante.
"It's too late for that, and we'd never get to the island in a craft this size, but at least we can use it to get away from this catastrophe."
"Then let us cast off, Altezza."
"Indeed."
Dante turned to the trembling crew.
"Cast off! Raise the sails! Look lively!"
At that moment, Ezio sprang from the shadows across the wharf and onto the boat. The frightened sailors made themselves scarce, diving into the murky lagoon.
"Get away from me, murderer!" shrieked Silvio.
"You've delivered your last insult," said Ezio, stabbing him in the gut and drawing the blades of his double dagger slowly across his belly. "And for what you said about my kinswomen, I'd cut your balls off with this if I thought it was worth it." Dante stood rooted to the spot. Ezio fixed him with his eye. The big man looked tired. "It's over," Ezio told him. "You backed the wrong horse."
"Maybe I did," said Dante. "I'm going to kill you anyway, you filthy assassin. You make me tired."
Ezio snapped out his pistola and fired. The slug hit Dante full in the face. He fell. Ezio knelt by Silvio to give him absolution. He was nothing if not conscientious, and always remembered that killing should only happen if there were no alternative, and that the dying, who very soon would have no rights at all, should at least be accorded the last rites. "Where were you going, Silvio? What is that galley? I thought you sought the Doge's seat." Silvio smiled thinly. "That was just a distraction. We were meant to sail." "Where?" "Too late," smiled Silvio, and died. Ezio turned to Dante and cradled the massive leonine head in the crook of his arm.
"Cyprus is their destination, Auditore," croaked Dante.
"I can perhaps redeem my soul at the last by telling you the truth.
They want...
But choking on his own blood, the big man passed on. Ezio searched both men's wallets, but found nothing except a letter to Dante from his wife. Shamefacedly, he read it.
"Amore mio, I wonder if ever the day will come when these words might make sense to you once more. I'm sorry for what I have done, for allowing Marco to take me from you, divorce you, and make me his wife. But now that he has died, I may yet find a way for us to be joined again. I wonder, though, if you will even remember me. Or were the wounds you suffered in battle too grave? Do my words stir, if not your memory, then your heart? But perhaps it doesn't matter what they say, because I know you're still in my heart, somewhere. I will find a way, my love, to remind you, to restore you. Forever yours, Gloria."
There was no address. Ezio folded the letter carefully and put it in his wallet. He would ask Teodora if she knew of this strange history, and if she could return the letter to its sender with news of the death of this faithless creature's true husband. He looked at the corpses and made the sign of the cross over them.
"Requiescat in pace," he said, sadly.
Ezio was still standing over the dead men when Bartolomeo came up, panting.
"So you didn't need my help, as usual," he said.
"Have you taken back the arsenal?"
"Do you think I'd be here if we hadn't?"
"Congratulations."
"Evviva!"
But Ezio was watching the sea. "We've got Venice back, my friend," he said, "and Agostino can rule it without further fear of the Templars. But I think there'll be little rest for me. Do you see that galley on the horizon?"
"Yes."
"Dante told me with his dying breath that it is bound for Cyprus."
"To what end?"
"That, amico, is what I need to find out." Chapter 21. Ezio could not believe it was Midsummer's Day in the year of Christ, 1487, his 28th birthday. He was by himself on the bridge of the Fistfighters, leaning on the balustrade and gloomily looking at the dank water of the canal beneath him. As he watched, a rat swam by, pushing a cargo of cabbage leaves, filched from the nearby greengrocer's barge, towards a hole in the black brick of the canal's bank. "There you are, Ezio," said a cheery voice, and he could smell Rosa's musky scent before he turned to greet her. "It's been too long. I might almost think you've been avoiding me."
"I've been busy."
"Of course you have. What would Venice do without you?" Ezio shook his head sadly, as Rosa leant comfortably on the balustrade beside him.
"Why so serious, Bello?" she asked.
Ezio gave her a deadpan look and shrugged.
"Happy birthday to me."
"It's your birthday? You serious? Wow!
Rallegramenti! That's wonderful."
"I wouldn't go that far," sighed Ezio.
"It's been over 10 years since I watched my father and brothers die. And I have spent 10 years hunting down the men responsible, the men on my father's list, and those added to it since his death. And I know I am close to the end now, but I'm no closer to understanding what any of it has really been for." "Ezio, you've dedicated your life to a good cause. It has made you lonely, isolated, but in one sense it has been your vocation. And though the instrument you have used to further your cause is death, you've never been unjust. Venice is a far better place now than it ever was because of you. So cheer up. Anyway, seeing as it's your birthday, here's a present. Very good timing as it happens."
She took out an official-looking logbook.
"Thank you, Rosa. Not quite what I'd imagined you'd give me for my birthday. What is it?"
"Just something I happened to pick up.
It's the shipping manifest from the Arsenal. The date your black galley sailed for Cyprus late last year is entered in it."
"Seriously?"
Ezio reached for the book, but Rosa teasingly held it away from him.
"Give it to me, Rosa. This isn't a joke."
"Everything has its price," she whispered.
"If you say so."
He held her in his arms for a long, lingering moment. She melted against him, and he quickly snatched the book away.
"Hey, that isn't fair," she laughed. "Anyway, just to spare you the suspense, that galley of yours is scheduled to return to Venice tomorrow."
"What, I wonder, can they have on board?
Why am I not surprised that someone not a million miles from here is going to find out?"
Ezio beamed. "Let's go and celebrate first." But at that moment a familiar figure bustled up. "Leonardo," said Ezio, greatly surprised.
"I thought you were in Milan."
"Just got back," replied Leonardo. "They told me where to find you. Hello, Rosa. Sorry, Ezio, but we really need to talk.
Now, this minute. Sorry."
Rosa laughed.
"Go on, boys, have fun. I'll keep."
Leonardo ushered a reluctant Ezio away.
"This had better be good," muttered Ezio.
"Oh, it is," said Leonardo placatingly.
He led Ezio along several narrow alleys until they arrived back at his workshop. Leonardo busied about, producing some warm wine and stale cakes, and a pile of documents which he dumped on a large trestle table in the middle of his study.
"I had your codex pages delivered to Monteregioni, as promised, but I couldn't resist studying them some more myself, and I've copied out my findings. I don't know why I'd never made the connection before, but when I put them together, I realized the markings and symbols and ancient alphabets can be decoded, and we seem to have struck gold, for all these pages are contiguous."
He interrupted himself.
"This wine is too warm. Mind you, I've got used to San Colombano. This Veneto stuff is like gnat's piss by comparison."
"Go on," said Ezio patiently.
"Listen to this."
Leonardo produced a pair of eyeglasses and perched them on his nose. He shuffled through his papers and read,
"The prophet will appear when the second piece is brought to the floating city."
Ezio drew in his breath sharply at the words.
"Prophet," he repeated.
"Only the prophet may open it. Two pieces of Eden."
"Ezio?"
Leonardo looked quizzical, doffing his eyeglasses.
What is it? Does this ring some kind of bell with you?
Ezio looked at him. He appeared to be coming to some kind of decision.
We've known each other a long time, Leonardo. If I can't trust you, there's nobody.
Listen, my Uncle Mario spoke of it long ago. He's already deciphered other pages of this codex, as had my father, Giovanni. There's a prophecy hidden in it, a prophecy about a secret ancient vault which holds something. Something very powerful.
Really? That's amazing.
But then a thought struck Leonardo.
Look, Ezio, if we've found all this out from the Codex, how much do the Barbarigi and the others you've been pitched against know about it? Maybe they know about the existence of this vault you mentioned too, and if so, that's not good.
Wait, said Ezio, his brain racing. What if that's why they sent the galley to Cyprus? To find this piece of Eden, and bring it back to Venice?
When the second piece is brought to the floating city, of course.
It's coming back to me. The prophet will appear. Only the prophet can open the vault.
My God, Leo, when my uncle told me about the Codex, I was too young, too brash to imagine that it was anything but an old man's fantasy. But now I see it plain. The murder of Giovanni Mocenigo, the killing of my kinsman, the attempt on the life of Duke Lorenzo, and the horrible death of his brother. It's all been part of his plan, to find the vault. The first name on my list. The one I have yet to strike a line through. The Spaniard.
Leonardo breathed deeply. He knew whom Ezio was talking about.
Rodrigo Borgia.
His voice was a whisper.
The same,
Ezio paused. The Cyprus galley arrives tomorrow. I plan to be there to meet it. Leonardo embraced him.
Good luck, my dear friend, he said.
The following dawn found Ezio, armed with his codex weapons and a bandolier of throwing knives, standing in the shadows of the colonnade near the docks, watching closely as a group of men, dressed in plain uniforms to avoid attracting undue attention, but discreetly displaying the crest of Cardinal Rodrigo Borgia, unloaded a plain-looking, smallish crate from a black galley which had recently put in from Cyprus. They handled the crate with kid gloves, and one of their number, under guard, hoisted it onto his shoulder and prepared to set off with it. But then Ezio noticed that several other guards were hoisting similar crates onto their shoulders, five of them in all. Did each crate contain some precious artifact, the second piece, or were all but one of them decoys? And the guards all looked the same, certainly from the distance at which Ezio would be obliged to shadow them. Just as Ezio prepared to break cover and follow, he noticed another man watching what was going on from a similar vantage point to his own. He suppressed an involuntary gasp as he recognized this second man as his